Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, that's right. Welcome to Infinite Sentence. I'm your host, Bill Patton. And, we like to talk to friends here on the show, in case you haven't noticed. So I'm excited to have Jim McLennan, a NorCal USPTA tennis pro, also one of the co-founders of TennisOne.com, and a very deeply philosophical tennis coach who's also a member of the Tom Stowe coaching line, which I know that that name keeps coming up on the show. Anyway, we're going to have a quick message here, and then we'll come back with Jim. So away we go.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Okay, we're back. And I think that was the fastest introduction ever. Hey, Jim, are you there?
I'm still here.
Okay, excellent. So how are you doing today, sir?
It's a nice afternoon. I was on court this morning, and I've got a good break.
Excellent.
I'm happy to do this.
No, I'm excited to have you on the show. And so tell us a little bit about your background as a player, and how did you get started in the sport?
Wow. Well, I used to bicycle up to Occalani's High School, where there was a freelance teaching pro, Blackie Jones, and there was a massive backboard along three courts that was probably 16 feet high. And so most of us in that neighborhood learned with Blackie and on the wall, and there were quite a number of people from that area that got into tennis: Scott Broviak, Jeff Broviak, Andy Webb, Ren Kern, Mort Yortsvang, and that was just in my little era. So I think it had most to do with the neighborhood in Lafayette, the backboard, and this wonderful guy, Blackie Jones. You know, that's how it all came about. And I just did all the other sports as well, but every year that I got older, I did less of everything and more of tennis, and then by the time I was in college, I was practicing constantly.
What a group of people you were with there. I didn't realize that that the Broviaks were also from Lafayette.
Yeah. In fact, the unusual story was that I met Blackie simply because I would bicycle up and sit under the trees and watch the lessons. And at first didn't really know him, but what I'm told, Scott has told me, that when Blackie first arrived in the area, he knocked on people's doors and said he was a tennis coach. And that's how he introduced himself to Bill Broviak, Jeff's dad. And it was, you know, it was wonderful public park tennis. And even when Jeff was inducted into the NorCal Hall of Fame some years ago, I brought Blackie as my guest, and I had no idea how many people knew him. I mean, it was because he is a lifetime tennis pro, and I, you know, he sort of inspired me without knowing it to do the same. So there you have it.
Tell us about your playing and how did it go. Tell us about different stages of your junior career, college career.
In the juniors, actually for the first number of years, I never won a match. I seemed to draw a seeded player every single time in the 14s. By the 16s, I was winning matches, and I got a ranking my last year in the 18s. Not all that high. I went to Chico State, had a wonderful time there for 2 years. As a sophomore, our team won the league. And actually, my doubles partner and I, who has since passed away, were on court for the final match against Sac State that would determine the league champs, and against really good players, Tom Pucci and Steve Turpin, far better than we were. And we won the match, very close match points both ways, and I can still see the match point that we won. My partner was on the baseline about to hit the ball. It was barely out. Instead of hitting it, he let it bounce and caught it. And everyone from Sacramento was booing, and everyone from Chico was cheering. And I still have many friends in Chico. Wayne Dawson was the coach. And then I transferred and went to Cal and walked on there. Chet Murphy was the coach. And they let me walk on, and then I played as a senior at Cal. So that's sort of how that went.
Well, I want to key in on something there because I believe that I'm forming a hypothesis that people remember these seminal moments from team matches because of the emotional impact, but they might not remember the same type of point or what have you from their own individual play. What do you think of that?
Well, I can remember most of the match points that I've lost. And most of the match points I've saved.
The exception.
Yeah, but I mean that was the most amazing college experience I could have had.
Absolutely.
And Jack was this wonderful guy. He was older than everybody else, and he and I had always played doubles. He gave me the nickname Challenger, and we've stayed in touch for many years, and then he, sadly, I'm outliving a lot of my old partners, for better or worse.
Yeah, I guess we're getting to that stage, yeah. So, now, who were some of your coaches that were very influential with you and helped you really solidify your game?
That's a good question, and I'll say three. Blackie, and I'm sure that's why I'm a teacher, but what he used to do was he always was asking questions of the students, and I think I've adopted that method. And, you know, the fancy name is exploration and guided discovery. But what he was doing then was that if the student couldn't answer the question, I was sitting on my bike in the shade, he'd throw it to me, and he convinced me to play tennis with him because I could answer the questions because I was maybe watching the lesson closer than the student. And really that method of teaching has so much value. Even at a conference in Miami 15 years ago, Townsend Gilbert presented a detailed explanation of exploration and guided discovery, and man, I believe in it, about saying far less than you normally would, far, far less, and seeing whether the student's curiosity and willingness to explore could get them to a better place than by just saying, well, here's how to do it. But then after I finished school, I had sort of a bad arm and shoulder, and I stopped for about 18 months. And then I went to Florida to play on the winter circuit and got a ride with Jim Irwin, who was Tom Stowe's assistant pro at Silverado. And so the entire way across the United States, I was hearing about Tom Stowe. I drove to New York, more Tom Stowe, Florida. And then when we came back in the spring, I started taking lessons from Tom, and you had to interview. It was very interesting, very difficult, and that's where I got my taste of the Tom Stowe system about much more attention to detail on balance than you'd ever imagine, much more attention to rhythm, and all about where you were on the court. And it seems to be in contradistinction from coaches that teach, call it from the outside in. They teach you the grip, they teach you the spin, and maybe they'll get on balance. And Tom was the opposite. And even in the men's open, I went from being sort of a middling men's open player to, in fact, in a period of a year, I had lost 0-1, and then at the end of the year beat the player of the year, Rich Anderson, in a three-set match, and it was all because of Tom. And so I teach that system still. Some of the skills I've lost, but even, and I think you're aware of it, Bill, we sponsored a Tom Stowe class at Fremont Hills that was open to the public, and I built a website material about it. But then the third coach, and this was the most unusual, was after being back and forth in Florida and so forth, I took a job in New Orleans, and one day I'm playing, and this was about 28, 29, so I was still pretty good, and I'm playing a match, and some guy walked up and said, truly, he said, "You're pretty good for somebody who doesn't know how to move." And as he walked away, his wooden leg was squeaking. And true story, his name is Don Kerr, and he was the Tulane tennis coach and an amputee. And we became lifelong friends. He trained a method called the gravity turn, which I've republished for him. And he was a very free-thinking guy. One, he was always experimenting. He was a badminton coach. We worked a lot on tinkering on the serve. And one day, in Florida when he was visiting, I did something that he particularly liked, and I sort of felt it on the serve, and as he said, "That's it," we both noticed sweat fly up from my fingertips straight up during the service hit. And he went inside and made a sketch, and in 2 days he had made a gizmo that would measure it, and within a couple of months we patented it. We were never able to sell them per se, but it was a measurement of angular momentum. And then because of that, I went back to graduate school and did a master's thesis on feedback and tennis skills. And so I think in some ways, and every tennis pro you interview probably has to tone down their ego, and hopefully I am, but it feels that between Blackie's questioning methods and Stowe's insistence on balance and knowing the court and Don's ideas about how to move and how to serve, I've got a really vibrant business now with adults and kids, provided they're open-minded and ambitious. And I teach them if they're not, but that's when I'm most effective.
Is there something that you're currently working on with, in terms of a project or an area of study?
Yeah. Three things, really. A couple of years ago, I presented material on how to develop the junior serve at a national conference in Monterey. And what fascinated me was that the USTA presented the identical seminar in the afternoon, and it was wildly divergent from what I presented. Not that I'm right and they're wrong, but it was way different. And I continue to try to show that they inadvertently were using Sharapova as a model for the serve, and I was trying to show that Sharapova is a model for not the serve. But I think that a lot of people can't sense that Serena's serve is good because of the mechanics, not because of how strong she is. But most of the coaches, I don't think, either have a grounding in biomechanics, or if they have a grounding in biomechanics, they never played tennis. And so I even sent material to Patrick McEnroe, no reply, even sent another note today about this, because I think that when I film Federer warming up his serve, he doesn't do any of the things that normally people are taught. He doesn't jump. He doesn't kick his back leg back. He doesn't snap his wrist. It's a very fluid motion. And I one of the projects I have is that I think coaches can teach that if they take enough time to study it. But
Let's go back to Serena, because I think that that's a great observation, and I'm surprised by that, because in my mind, she has one of the finest motions there's ever been. So how would you rate her serve just on technique if you take the power out?
No, it's excellent. I think that the keys when you're doing anything is you measure if they're on balance, is it rhythmic, and is it effortful or effortless. And in fact, I was involved in some research. I was sort of the fly on the wall at Stanford when they were measuring women's serves in the WTA and trying to get information about why so many of them have a bad shoulder. And the protocol that they used to measure the serves, and in fact, I know the guy that, in fact, I'm coaching the sons of the guy that made the protocol. We don't see eye to eye on this, but there was nothing in the protocol about whether there was balance or rhythm. It was just checkpoints. In other words, so that, you know, if you toss the ball as high as Steffi did, she served pretty good because she had other things right, but she went through every position that you can check off, but not with a sense of rhythm. And so the gizmo that Don and I made then kind of measured rhythm, not exactly, but so that led me there. But I'm on to something even now more interesting. There's a wonderful book called Mindset written by Jackie Reardon, and I would encourage any listener to get it as soon as they can. There's two books by the same name. The other one's written by a professor at Stanford, Carol Dweck, but the mindset for tennis is outstanding, and it's all about attitude. And I am fascinated now to see that many of the kids that we work with, the better players just have a better attitude. They don't even hit the ball any better. And I'm still not sure that I can help anybody change their attitude, but I've got many resources that at least I could give them if they were to choose to do that. That includes even meditation. And in the book Mindset, this author recommends that everybody determine what aspect of their tennis game, if they change, would they get markedly better. And then 5 minutes every morning, you have to be meditating on that thought. And I'm not
interject
pro meditation.
Allow me to interject for a second, because I'm reminded of a quote from William James, and I'm going to butcher it. It's something to the effect of, the thing that separates humans from animals is their ability to change their attitude.
Really?
That's a paraphrase. So that's from the very birth of American psychology. And then,
say it again.
The thing that separates humans from animals is the ability to change one's attitude.
Wow. Of course, you know.
That's pretty deep. And then the other one was, and I think this is one of those funny ones where it says 95% of what you can learn is based on your attitude. And I don't want to quibble about the percentage, but even if it's only 50% influential, and as a not only a high school teacher but also as a coach, I've seen that, you know, where that the attitude of that you bring to it is so much more important sometimes than your physical skill level or whatnot. So,
well, you know, when you on that topic, I can remember. Not often, but occasionally at Silverado, somebody wouldn't really be responding to Tom, or they were resisting or what have you, and he'd throw them out and really say, you know, I can't work with you, you're not. And what would happen was that anybody that was in the vicinity would just, you know, and then Tom would come to me and say, well, let's work on this, and you already knew you couldn't resist him for fear of being thrown out. But what I'm intrigued about now is whether or not you could build a tennis program where the kids or the adults couldn't get in until they already proved they had a good attitude. So that, because you're saying that they can change attitudes, but I don't see that as much as I wish I did. And even now we have a young left-handed, just turned 13, and she has crazy potential because of her attitude. Fascinating. And I got a 14 that's almost internationally ranked, and the only struggle is attitude, and we've struggled with that for a long time. And so then, you see, I think you could take William James' quote and turn it on its head. Animals live in the present. humans have the capacity to live in the past and the future because of their ego. And that's where the attitude gets all messed up. I remember I screwed that shot up. I think I'm going to screw the next shot up. Whereas if a cat's chasing a mouse, the cat's never thinking to himself, what do I tell my friends if the mouse escapes? So that's the exact opposite approach to William James, but there's some truth to that.
Well, I mean, people can change their minds or they can choose not to. The choice is theirs. You know, I'm also a big Kierkegaard fan, and we have the choice, you know, to become more self-aware or less so, and more alienated from people or more intimate with them. So,
you find that in your life that you've seen people have changed?
Oh yeah. Yeah, all the time. That's the way I operate. I'm a change maker, and I like when I see people changing their minds about things. Absolutely. Here, I'll give you an example. I had a kid, and he's been taking lessons with me for about a couple of months, and his skill level went way up, but his self-image did not improve. So his self-image kept dragging his play down. So I finally had to blast him, and I said, "Look, your play is up here, and you have the ability to do this, but you just don't believe that you're a good tennis player, and you are. You're a fine tennis player. So, can you please say to me, I'm a good tennis player?" And he did. And then it was amazing the transition that happened within a 7-day period, where not only did he improve on the day, but then he came back the next week with a big smile on his face, and we didn't have the whole 3 steps forward, 2 steps back that we usually have on a weekly basis. So, on that note, sorry to be indulgent there, but when we come, let's talk about some of the unique aspects of your coaching, but we're going to go to a commercial, and so let's kind of key into some principles that are your immutables. Let me get back here.
Okay.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At ussportcamps.com, you can plan out a Nike tennis camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit ussportcamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike tennis camp at www.ussportcamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike tennis camps and take your game to the next level.
All right, thanks for that. Now, so what are some of the kind of the immutable principles that you try to begin people with when they first come out for a Jim McClain lesson?
Wow. Well, nothing's immutable because I think I teach different than I used to, and I think what I try to do is ask as many questions as I can about, are they ice skaters? Were they dancers? Are they ping pong players? Are they musical? Many times if there's somebody who's musical, I try to introduce rhythm and beats. And then in a very gentle way, I just like to hit it back and forth. And maybe when they're out of breath, start a dialogue about what it is they feel. So that, let's say I see that the posture is off and the footwork sequence is labored. If after we stop and talk and they don't say anything about that, I don't always go there. I want to go to a spot where they say something that they feel. And if that doesn't work, then what I try to do is go to the thing that they do best and try to show them a bit about how they do that, so that then let's say they use their hips really well on a forehand and not at all on the backhand. Then I might drop a bunch of balls on the forehand point out how smooth it is, ask them if they were ever told to do it, and hopefully they say no, they just do it naturally, and then I try to show them that on the backhand. But I think that yesterday I had dinner with a good friend of mine who's a retired Buddhist minister and also he's a professional counselor, and he made this wonderful dialogue about how he thought his role was to listen until the truth or the pain, as he said, bubbled up and out. And I think too often the teachers are approaching a lesson like they're supposed to teach. And I think the fun is to try to approach it where I'm not trying to teach anything. I'm just trying to give them a chance to learn something. And even where I work, one of the pros has made a comment that he's never heard anybody talk as little as I do. And I don't know if that's a good or a bad sign, but even in the book Mindset, Jackie Reardon, it's probably why I like the book, she recommends hiring a pro that doesn't talk much. So but I look at balance, I look at posture. I want to know what their goals are. I'm not all that interested in teaching them anything that's absolute at all. And I think that I'm really, really patient, so that it could take 4, 5, 6, 8 lessons to even get to the point that a young person becomes curious. And if it took 8 lessons, then that's okay. But once they're curious, then I think a lot more can happen. And it's really fun to watch tennis. And, you know, some people see the court. Some people just see the ball. Some people just think it's about hitting. Some think it's about fitness. And more or less, it's about all that stuff, even to the point of friends of mine encouraged me to take a class in improv theater. And there's a book, Improv Wisdom, that is just brilliant. And it's about living an improv life. But almost every chapter could be made directly into tennis, because you can't control what you get from the opponent, and you can't control the scene in improv. And I'm fascinated by the inflexibility I encounter in some players or students. And then I remember when I used to play in the men's open and would always lose to him, the most improv, present-centered person that ever was Whitney Reed. There's that, and you know, maybe in modern game that was Fabrice Santoro or McEnroe, but it's counterintuitive. And even we have a friend that in college played with Antonio Palafox, which apparently is McEnroe's coach, and I'd love to interview him at some point to determine whether he just saw that Mac was going to do it his own way and he let him do it. Because McEnroe's tennis is elegant, and it's not classical or immutable at all. It's just about the ball and the racket.
While you were talking, I was reminded that the root of education is the Latin verb educos, which means to draw from within.
So, you know some stuff, man.
Well, I've read a book or two, you know, but thank you. No, and you know, when we reflect on our best teachers, you know, it was those teachers that drew something out of us that we didn't know was there. Those are our favorite ones of all time, because they knew how to do that. But the other ones that were just trying to drill a hole in our head and hope that we would love their subject as much as they did, that wasn't quite as effective. But then the other thing was, your compliment threw me off.
Educos, good for you. Jeez, I don't know that word.
So it sounds like you definitely draw out that from your student in that way.
Let's say I try. That's you know, more than that, it's unproven. But I definitely try to do that.
Okay. Oh, then the other thing came back to me was that I don't remember who said this. It may have been you, but that Tom Stowe largely drew his teaching philosophy from having observed Don Budge as he coached him.
Yes.
Was that you?
Yes. Well, so, you know, in fact, some would say that Budge taught, that Don taught Tom, but Yeah, I mean, basically everyone was trying to be taught how Don did it. So even I'd be out there and I'd be moving around and he'd say, man, when Don would move, you couldn't hear him. And they'd look at me, you know, with this scowl and a smile and says, now your shoes are too loud, you know. And so there was always something there, always. And, you know, there was about boxing. And even I'm working on something now where I'm going to try to, you know, I have my own website that I work on in addition to Tennis One, and we do an awful lot of publishing, and we're going to, one of the projects next year will be to create a course sort of for teachers but also for students, and do it in Northern Cal where people that teach that system are invited to have a teaching court, and then students can sort of wander around and take this and take that, and because some of the people have allowed this system to grow, truly, and others are teaching it faithfully as it still was. And I don't have a preference about where it should be at all. I just think it's fun to do all this stuff, because even with the USPTA, what was best about it for me was just to get hooked up with all these people that were studying tennis, sharing their ideas, and so I'm a connector.
Well, you know, let's talk about that Palm Stowe day that you put on, because I thought that one of the remarkable things was the remarkable contrasts between how people now manifest having learned from Palm and now make it their own. We're going to have Don King on the show here coming up soon, but you're different than Steve Stefanke is different than John Hubble. But you see certain elements. So I think what you should do is change the word from system to milieu or something like that. Sorry, my French is really great. But, you know, there might be a better word to capture that, because it seems as though it might not be systemic.
Well, that's pretty deep. But, I guess what I feel is that, at least with Tom and his book, there was a method and a progression, and when I see my colleagues, I'm not sure that there's a clear, nor I'm sure they could criticize me of the same. Is there a path? I don't know. I mean, I think that what was interesting was just that all the guys were talking about sort of similar stuff, but not similar stuff, and I think even more so, and you're going to have Doug on, for me, what I'm fascinated by is whether or not the material is accessible and whether or not the material requires more dialogue or less. And don't even know if I'm any good on it, but a lot of times even with the kids, I think what's so fun is to try to present something like timing, which is, we know what timing is, but if you're 10 years old and they're early or late, how do you explain it so that you don't just say it and then say, do you understand? But right. Can they show you? And so even, you know, between Steve, all those guys that day, what I didn't do well, I don't think, was monitor or dominate or stop or have more dialogue, because Steve explains it much different than Doug, who explained it different than John, who explained it different than Jim Irwin, who was the man that introduced me. And, you know, at the end of the day, the teacher's just trying to pass something along. That's it. And I wasn't sure that we were as clear as we could have been. Or that's why I want to try it again on court.
Right. So what's the name of the Tom Stowe book? Is it available?
Wow. Yeah. In fact, I think I've got it listed on my website. I want to say it's the Tom Stowe Teaching System, and it's out of print. And Brent Abel sells a PDF of it. And, it was written in 1948, the year I was born, and some of it's a little outdated because Tom was much more about a weight shift than he was about rotation on the hit. But yeah, I like it. I mean, you know, because even you've worked with those eight boards and so forth, and that's always
right.
about posture and where the center is, and I think that's very important for students. I remember once at a conference in Monterey, I brought Henry Kamakana, and in fact, I was moderating a dialogue where they would ask either Henry or myself questions, and after a few minutes, they just asked no one asked me anything, which was, that was okay with me. But at one point, somebody said, you know, there was a dialogue, what could you show somebody if they bought a series of 10 or 15 lessons? And people are responding, you know, all they could do. And then Henry even said, maybe I'll get them on balance. And what he implied
right.
was that he wants a student for 50 lessons, but they wouldn't get any work done until the student got on center. And that's a story, man. So anyway, that's about it, you know, meditation, mindset, footwork, exploration, guided discovery, and I work 6 days a week.
Yeah, my listeners are getting tired of this story, but I'll try to share it quick. I took over a junior program, and no junior who in the program who also happened to have modern-looking strokes had a contact point that was anywhere near regular, and none of them were on balance at all. But they were happy to hit one out of four shots very well. So, okay, moving on. So now, tell us about Tennis One. How did that all get started, and what's going on with it now?
Tennis One is probably almost 22 years. Kevin Pope and Monty Bazniak were tennis pros at Mission Hills in Fremont, and one of the members, Kim Shanley, had an idea to build a website, and Kevin knew that I was doing some writing, so they brought me in, and I was the editor for many years. They still call me the editor, but I wouldn't say I'm an active editor. They probably have an audience. We probably have an audience now of about between 75 to 100,000 people. We publish once a week with online instruction. There's a huge video library called Pro Strokes Gallery, where you can dial up and say, I want to watch, you could click on Djokovic, then you could scroll down forehand, then you could scroll rear view up the line, and then you can watch that in high definition and slow motion. So if you're studying, it's a great place to go. Doug King's one of the primary writers now. The other thing that Kim has done is, and he's a very capable publisher, is we had eTennis Team, which was a device where captains could manage their teams using proprietary software. And now we've expanded it to something called Team Tracks, which is way more useful, such that if it's a USTA match at 2 o'clock today and it's raining, with one click of a button, all players would get a text on their phone. and so the captaining process that all the USTA captains do is really the target of Team Tracks. And I think that the other thing is that they're selling a lot of courses now, especially Doug King's. And so the business model on the Internet, at first we were, I would say, a membership instructional magazine, and now we're a membership instructional magazine as well as a purveyor of online instruction. So you can go to Tennis One as a member or not as a member. Some is protected and some isn't. But I think that we were one of the first. And it's interesting in the market now how big it's gone. It's very easy for people to create their own website. So that's Tennis One. And you know, it'd be interesting. I'd really ask the listeners to go there. If you've never been there, just check it out, because it's a labor of love for Kim and Doug and Dave Smith and Ken DeHart and so many others that work hard on this stuff. And even, you know, when I look at a tennis magazine and so forth, after a while, there's not much more you can say about the game. So that even for me, having been writing for so many years about this, a lot of times I go back to the same theme and try to put a new spin on it, but there's not much more than where you're on the court and where the opponent's on the court and what kind of ball you're getting and what you want to do with it.
Well, I think part of the great value of what you're doing there is that people can sort through and look at players who have a similar physique to themselves and or a similar playing style, personality, and take a close look and model themselves after that. I mean, as I was growing up, I modeled myself after Bjorn Borg, and you know, that was a mistake because I'm not, my personality is not that same thing. So it was a friend of mine who encouraged me to really become much more involved in playing at the net, and that really revolutionized my game, and then I started to model myself after people who played like that. So, you know, worth watching keenly what they did and all that. So, you know, it's really amazing to me how you find these kids who are probably going to be no taller than 5'7" and maybe 115 pounds, but they want to play like Rafa.
Yeah, but, you know, you can't, but even apparently in the last excellence tournament, some little guy won the 18s with less of everything than the opponent other than just the will to win. I don't know the names, but I just heard that this guy didn't look like he had much, but he had a lot. And so, yeah, I don't know. I think maybe you just let people – I mean, maybe it was good that you went the Borg route to discover it wasn't you.
Mm.
You know, that could have been that could have been a valuable detour.
Yeah. So yeah, that's a great counter because absolutely people need to go through the process. So let's shift it kind of to the advice section of the show where, you know, say there's a player or a parent of a player or a coach and they want to get to be a professional tennis player or a strong Division I level college player. What kind of advice do you give a player as they're trying to develop their game?
How old are we talking?
Let's say they're 13 and they have a decent ranking, so it's all still in front of them if they're going to work.
Wow. Well, I think you have to embrace first who they are inside so that if they're cautious, you work on their defense, and if they're gambling, you work on their shot making, but you try not to make them what they're not. But more than that, I would say I would encourage them to drill less and play more. And on that score, on Fridays, we do something with kids where for 2 hours, all they do is play matches. No instruction at all from me. But I walk around and ask questions about why they're winning and losing. And if I didn't insist, most of the kids would hit for the first hour because that's what they do when they practice. They just hit. And I don't see that the kids learn the court or learn the importance of the second serve or the return of serve. And so, to me, if you wanted somebody to become a serious player, I'd say they could drill one day a week. That would be enough. And the rest of the time would have to be in play. And they'd have to have a really competent coach. And some are more competent than others. The one that I recommend around here is Henry Kamakana, and one that has had success taking kids sort of a long way, but also I guess they have to have an eye for it. And even with some of the good kids that I get a chance to work with now, quite a number of them have had multiple coaches showing them wildly different things, not right or wrong, just different. And I think that there should be continuity amongst coaches. But I think that they have to play a lot. I guess the other two from knowing Don Kerr is that if, in spite of everything else, I'd like them to be extremely quick without being powerful and have a really fluid serve. And I think those two can take you a long way,
mm-hmm.
but the hitting doesn't. So that would be what I'd say.
Yeah, it becomes sort of mindless and dull. And so you'll be glad to know that when I coach a high school team, there's almost zero, quote, hitting. Everything's a game, or it's a drill with a very specific shot combination, or this or that, the other thing. And if the kids ever hear me say, hey, hold on a second, everybody just go hit for 5 minutes, they know there must be some kind of emergency. Because hitting is mindless and lazy, and people will hit back to each other to keep the rally going. So
yeah.
There's no creativity there.
Well,
there's
but it's fun also.
Well,
you know.
I mean, it's okay to be mindless and lazy on your own time, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, your specific purpose is to gain rhythm and develop a higher shot rally number, then excellent. But if you're doing it with no objective, then it's not, I don't think it's a productive time.
Yeah. What do you advise people that are trying to get to that elevated spot?
What I recommend to people is they look at the totality of what a tennis player needs in order to be successful and work on all of it. You need to be fit. You need to work on your mental game. You need to understand strategy in its whole, but you also have to understand your A game, your B game, and if you can develop a C game, then more power to you. You need to understand preparation and fitness and injury management. And,
But isn't it true that there are some 16-year-olds that know all of that and still you can tell there's something missing?
Well, you know, a lot of times, if I ever see that thing is missing, then I always talk about them, ask them, why are you doing this? And then they give their stock answer, and I say, well, why do you want to do that? And they give their stock answer. Then we go through that process of going down to what the real subconscious answer is. Sometimes it takes a while to plumb.
Well, there you get back to mindset. You know, you remember Fred Earle and from the USPTA, and he, towards the end of his life, took me under his wing and was mentoring me. And I give all the students this. He had 5 keys for building self-confidence, and it's a wonderful. And if at the end of any day you can say yes to all 5 questions, you're on the right path. And even maybe this would be is all you'd ever need is that. And over the years, only a few people lived this, and this little 13-year-old is this way, but his 5 keys were, you had to be able to say yes honestly to each answer. Today I gave 100% mentally and physically. Most kids can do that. Number 2, today no matter what happened, I stayed positive. Now it gets harder. Today I'm patient. Today I'm learning from my mistakes. That's a very hard one. And today I accept full responsibility for myself. And whenever I ask the kids that I work with, I want them to memorize it in that order. And it invariably, when somebody forgets one of the 5, it is always the one that they don't live. And that's unconscious. Always.
How convenient.
Always. Yeah.
Okay, so moving on to parents, what kind of advice would you have for parents as they're helicoptering or not?
Wow. Never use the word should. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I have all kind of parents I know, and I'm not sure. I'm a parent, and I don't know that, you know, just like your thought about William James, I don't even know if parents can choose their attitude. I think it's more, there's a wonderful book by Martin Seligman, Learned Optimism, and it, he creates sort of a metaphor about how you look at life, and it's an excellent book. And among many other things in there, you come across this thing that says that the child gets the predominant optimism, pessimism attitude from the primary caregiver. And the best kid that had ever come out of Fremont Hills to date, played at Stanford, his mother was just the best parent, and she didn't even have a footprint. And I've never forgotten that about whether or not it's just, you know, the attitude of the kid is what's been given. I don't know. I mean, I think if maybe I could even say that maybe there's no parents listening, is that if the parents need advice, there's already a problem.
Oh, that's deep. And so I'm assuming that you mean parents didn't have a footprint, meaning they didn't have a footprint in the tennis development of the player.
Yeah.
I mean, and so it goes back to, you know, coaches coach, players play, and parents love and drive and pay. And it should be that simple. Are you familiar with a guy named Ray Brown in Texas?
I know the name, but I don't know who he is.
He recently shared a great article about theory X, Y, and now Z. Right, so you know, theory X is that workers don't want to work and they have to be forced. Theory Y is that people find inherent value from working. But theory Z, which I had just learned, is that everyone finds a lifelong learning path through all the useful tasks that they do throughout their life. So I loved that because it helped me to identify that I'm a Theory Z coach who's coaching a Theory Z player who has Theory Z parents. So I'm promoting.
How do you get that situation?
Because you interview people before they get started, and I'm not accepted by Theory X parents. I know that for sure.
Really?
Theory X will not send their kid to me. It's very
interesting. Tell me again, what is Theory X again?
Theory X is that workers are lazy. People are lazy, and they need to be made to work.
Oh, I gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. Huh. It's like turn of the century, you know, turn of the 20th century management science.
So meaning they want you to make them work.
No, they don't want you to. They don't want to work. They need to be made to work.
Well,
theory
so
being
a Theory X student wants a coach that's going to bust their chops.
No, a Theory X student has a Theory X parent who has drilled into them that they are lazy.
Oh.
So it's a bad system. It's not, yeah. So they look for... So they will look for the quasi-abusive academy to drill into their child the work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the law of attraction at work. So Jim, we're getting near the end here. If you had to sum up this conversation into one or two points that would be great take-homes for people as they're listening to this while they're running the treadmill or what have you. So... What would you like people to really grasp from this talk?
I guess expose yourself to something different. See whether dance would help your tennis. See whether badminton would help your tennis. See whether sort of, I guess I would say, get outside the box and see if there's a resource you never thought of. Even now I'm trying to recruit. In fact, I'll put this out on the net. I want to find a young person that's very skilled at ping pong and badminton and do an experiment and coach them for free. Because I'm seeing that ping pong players have a good feel for one-handed spin of the ball, and badminton players can serve instantly.
Mm-hmm.
And those are both non-traditional training methods. So yeah, that's I would say, yeah, get out of the box and put up my email so they could send me a question on my website.
So let's wrap up with this. Why don't you give us your contact information here, and then we'll call it a wrap.
The website that I've created with my next-door neighbor is called EssentialTennisInstruction.com. It's kind of a long name. And I'm Jim at EssentialTennisInstruction.com, and we publish podcasts and commentary and then a full line of online instructional products, as well as we put all that stuff up about Tom Stowe. I also work at Fremont Hills Country Club. I'm the tennis director, so you can get me Jim@FremontHills.com, Jim@EssentialTennisInstruction.com, or McLennan@Tennis1.com. But I like the Internet, and I like doing emails, and I'm happy to connect with anybody that shoots me something.
And, yeah, don't be confused. Fremont Hills is in Los Altos.
Yes.
Do not
All
go
right,
to
Bill,
Fremont.
I'm happy. Are you happy?
I am very happy. Hey, thanks so much for coming on the show, and hopefully I'll see you at the fall conference, but if not, hopefully soon.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. All right. So Jim McLennan, you know, that guy has a lot to say, and very, very deep philosophically, and I'm always challenged by his out-of-the-box thinking and how nothing's finite, nothing's immutable, and the guided discovery of helping people find their best tennis. All right. Well, that's it for today, and so it's going to go like this. I'm going to throw a couple different things at you. First, this one.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.